2026, King versus United States. Okay, Mr. Messing.
May it please the court. Every once in a while, a case gives you a pretty clear indication that the decision below was wrong. One such indication is when the government, which won below, completely abandons the reasoning of the court that decided the opinion. That's what happened here.
So your clients had a contract right to payments from the fund, right?
That's correct.
They don't have an interest in the underlying assets of the fund.
They don't have an ownership stake, but they have a beneficial interest. It's deferred compensation that was paid each month from the work that they did into the fund.
They had a contract right to that.
They had a contract right to that, okay. Just like the bank in Louisville Bank, for instance, just like the lien holder in Armstrong.
Well, actually, in Louisville, the Supreme Court says that they had an interest in the real property, and they distinguished it from a contract right as a creditor, and said that's fundamentally different.
What you just said is exactly what we may view the implications of that differently, but you noted that they had an interest in the property. My clients had an interest in the specific pool of funds. They didn't own it, just like the bank didn't own the house on which it had a mortgage. Okay. It had an interest.
So what is the taking here? Was it an order that the contract right be transferred to somebody else? Is it that it was transferred to the government? What is the alleged taking?
Thank you. Paragraph 104 of our second amended complaint specifies exactly what we allege. That's also in ECF 166, where we specify it in our summary judgment motion. There are several things that were taken. First,
what was taken. What I asked was, got it.
Oh, I'm just creating a record so you can find it when you want to see exactly what we alleged, because it's exactly what the CFC said. They had a vested right to receive a pension of a specific size from a specific source.
My question is, where was the transfer? Was the government transferring that to a third party? Was it taking it for itself? What's the alleged?
The government authorized the pension fund to appropriate that. So, and the fund did so. It quite literally deleted the language from the contract.
The idea is that it ordered a transfer of property to the pension fund?
The transfer of property, it was the appropriation of property. The word transfer as a practical matter, that's what happened. But in practice, since they had a contractual right to payment.
So it's not an argument that the government took the property for itself. It's that it ordered a transfer of the property to the pension fund.
It authorized the pension fund to appropriate the property, and the fund did exactly that.
Okay. And so what case is there where a modification of a contract right by the government, not a government contract, but a third-party contract, has been held to be a taking? I've looked at all the cases that you cited. I didn't see that those cases involve contract rights per se. They all involve property.
To be clear, the remedy was also deleted. As a practical matter, that's what happened in Brown. People submit deposits to a bank. They have a right to interest.
But the Supreme Court held in Brown that there was an interest, a property interest in the money, in the interest, not just a contract right. What case says that the government modification of a contract right is a per se taking.
That the transfer of interest in the property, in the contract right. So I don't understand how that's not, right. So, Armstrong and Louisville Bank eliminated the remedy. Brown and Webb's transferred the ownership right. This case goes beyond those. There was a right.
All
it was quite literally
involved an interest in property,
right.
Not just a contract right.
If Your Honor's point is that this case goes further than any case that we've cited, that's true. In this case, there was the on-bank opinion that you wrote in Commonwealth Edison, there are basically two camps, rules of liability, which, as this court said, the government can impose taxes, no problem. Usage fees, no problem. Insurance mandate, no problem. But if you take the actual property right and appropriate it, then you cross the line.
Okay, but that's the problem, that all these cases involve property rights, whereas your clients have a contract right.
They have the court below found, after extensive briefing, that my clients did have a property right.
Well, you have a property right in a contract, but it's not a property right.
So this goes to exactly the line that Your Honor drew.
Don't interrupt. Not a property right in the underlying assets of the fund.
They do have a property interest in that. Their deferred compensation went into a fund that had well over $1 billion in it. It was backed exactly the language in Commonwealth Edison and roughly 10 other cases that we cited where when there was a right backed by a specific pool of money or a specific asset. Time and again, this court and the Supreme Court say
The plan here says specifically that they don't have an interest in the underlying assets of the fund, right?
They have you'd have to cite me a specific page, Your Honor.
Well,
because the entire point of the pension is you put money in, it's deferred compensation, and you get it out.
94, paragraph 5. Neither employer or any other person shall have any right, title, or interest in or to the fund estate or any part thereof, except that they have a contract.
My recollection of the trust document is, and I don't know exactly which page you're citing, but immediately after that it says, except beneficiaries.
Yeah, except the contract, right.
That's pretty important language, which is no one shall have a right in this except the exact people I'm representing as part of a class.
The problem is that the Supreme Court cases have consistently distinguished, and Louisville being one of them, between a contract right, third-party contract right, which can be modified, and an interest in an asset, which perhaps under some circumstances can result in a per se take.
And this is, the right itself is an asset. It's the equivalent of commercial paper. It's the equivalent of a private annuity backed by a specific fund. It's equivalent to being a trust beneficiary where there's money there for your benefit.
What's your best case?
Brown.
Brown?
Yeah.
Okay. But Brown, there was an interest in the money in the bank.
It was interest. It was both the principal and the interest in the money in the bank. And it was transferred to a third party, just like here, where my clients owned it and then suddenly it went to someone else. And 9-0, the court said it's a per se taking. So, again, I want to reiterate the Commonwealth Edison distinction. I urge the court to reread it. Of course, Judge Dyke, you wrote it. You're intimately familiar with it. It creates two worlds. Is there a specific right backed by a specific pool of money or a specific piece of property? And Your Honor cited Webbs and Phillips for that proposition. And in that case, you move into per se land. By contrast, this court's given such broad latitude to the government. Pretty much anything else. You're imposing liability? No problem. You're appropriating an arbitration clause that says you get to arbitrate in North Korea, and you say, I really wanted to do that. I expected it. Tough luck. The government can take that away. You pay an insurance fee.
In your theory, in A and D, would there have been a per se taking?
There was no authorization. The government didn't authorize the car companies. What's that?
They coerce.
Well, I understand. And below, we argued as alternative theories, the government's on the hook, even though it didn't end up with the property, because of authorization.
What's the answer to my question? In A and D, would it have been a per se taking?
So A and D would not have been a per se taking unless it had been authorization. If the government had said...
Because it was just coercion and not authorization?
So we have something beyond A&D, Your Honor. If A&D was about a contractual right that wasn't backed by specific property, but pretend it said that the car dealers owned specific cars and had the right to those specific cars, had already prepaid for them, and had a property interest in it. And then A&D said... Congress said, we're going to allow Chrysler to void those agreements and reclaim those cars, even though there's a property interest in them. Then Chrysler goes ahead and says, ooh, great, we get to keep these for ourselves. And they literally change the contract. So it says, instead of dealers have a property interest in this, instead it now says Chrysler has a property interest in this. Then yes, we're in that realm, and that's exactly what happened here. So to be clear, the contract was literally rewritten, eliminating my client's vested property rights, and the remedy was eliminated.
Do you think of the property interest here as if the fund is a debtor to the plaintiffs?
In a practical sense, yes. In a literal sense, it's a trust. It's money held in trust for their benefit.
Right, and then I guess to try to understand the nature of whatever interest, the claims court talked about how whatever expectation there was of receiving payments, it was against the backdrop of certain things, certain limitations. For example, there's a termination clause in the plan. There's also ERISA, which itself talks about certain exceptions to the anti-cutback rule, one of them being a substantial business injury to the fund, then the fund needs to take exigent acts in order to save the fund. And so therefore, the court concluded that what happened here with the 2014 Act is just a thematic extension of all these different limitations on a pension holder's expectations of receiving a certain sum of payments. What would you say about that?
That misreads Connolly and 100 years worth of case law. The contractual remedies for if there's not enough money, that's the point. My clients had an agreement that said, you will be paid this amount until the day you die, and it's absolutely ironclad unless A, B, or C. If there's not enough money to pay, if it's insolvent, then that goes away. And what Congress did is said, we'd like to broaden the situations in which we can take away that vested property right backed by a specific fund. And we're going to say it's not just when it's insolvent, it's when you're starting to get a little too close for comfort.
Do you agree that insolvency. The plan is subject to ERISA?
Yes.
Okay, so then it's subject to these exceptions, including substantial business injury.
That specific exception is for, which the government cited, is not for vested pensions. That's for accrued benefits, which have not vested, and that's a very different level of protection in terms of the property interest.
Right. And then here, getting back to one of Judge Dyke's questions, we seem to be in kind of an unusual situation, maybe a unique situation, where what was the objective here? What was the congressional objective to have these funds cut back payments? It was, in a way, it was to help protect these very plaintiffs and all similarly situated pension holders. So in order to have the fund survive, and it was apparently on its pathway, a one-way ticket to extinction. And so by making these choices and maneuvers, it allows the fund to live at least a few more decades. So again, I think this is consistent with Judge Dyke's question. We don't have a situation where the government is taking money, taking property interests, and moving it from person A to person B, or giving it to itself, the government, for some other purpose. Its objective is to help the plaintiffs themselves in a way. Obviously, some of the plaintiffs won't be alive to see all the benefits down the road, to see the fund survive an extra couple decades. But nevertheless, the broader objective is to save these plaintiffs. So I'm just trying to understand Is there an example of a case where that was the situation and the courts nevertheless concluded, sorry, that's still a taking?
Sure. This court did so in Casitas. There wasn't enough water for everyone. One party at the plaintiff had a contractual right to a specific amount of water, like money flowing to them. They had a right to exactly that amount. Did they own the water? No. Had they had possession of it? No. They had a right to it.
We did say they owned the water. They had a right to the water.
They had a contractual right to the water.
Well, no, but we didn't characterize
it. It wasn't a riparian right, Your Honor. It was a contractual right. And that right was modified. The water was diverted elsewhere, and the court found a per se taking, and rightly so. So that's one example by this court, where the idea that there is a pool of water or money where you have the right to a particular amount flowing to you, and then that gets cut off because of government action. It's awfully similar.
But what was the purpose of that government action?
So that there was enough water to achieve various important goals in other places.
Right, that's the point. That was to achieve goals in other places. Here, it's to achieve goals for right here, this situation, to save this plan from going bankrupt.
Right, Louisville Bank. It was during the Depression, and this court has, the Supreme Court has repeatedly warned. We've heard all sorts of Pandora's box arguments, and oh no, what happens if we obliterate property rights? But isn't that dangerous? And the court says, let's look to see if there's a property right and protect it. Is it backed by a specific fund? Was it appropriated? If so, you've got a taking.
Okay,
and so Louisville Bank.
The problem with Louisville is that it says specifically, it's true that the position of a secured creditor who has rights in the specific property differs fundamentally that from an unsecured creditor has not.
You don't think my right. I realize I don't get to ask the questions, but rhetorically, you don't think my clients, after working 30 years and having their compensation deferred and put in every month, have any rights in that fund when they have a specific right down to the penny for how much they get? I don't understand how that's different, respectfully, than Casitas or Brown, where, for instance, you haven't yet sold a property, but the money comes in escrow, and then you have a right to the interest because it's for your benefit.
If my colleagues will indulge me, I've got a few questions as well.
I see that my time is up.
No, you can answer.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you. You started with Judge Dyke, and you said repeatedly this case goes beyond other cases. Did you mean that the governmental action here goes beyond other governmental actions that have been found as takings, or did you mean something different?
Thank you. I don't mean the nature of the government action under Penn Central. I'm not referring to that prong. I'm talking in terms of per se. So in many cases...
Are you asking us to go beyond takings doctrine, or are you saying that
government
has done something that goes beyond?
I'm saying that this is an easier case than most because the government has gone beyond. For instance, in Louisville or Armstrong, the government impaired the creditor's right to enforce a contractual agreement. And even though they still had that clause and it was blocked as a practical matter, they still had that right. Had the legislation been repealed, they could have pulled out the exact same contract and said, okay, we're back in business, we're enforcing it. Here, that right was removed, and as concerns Your Honor, Judge Dyke, in Pizzell, the remedy was removed. Congress immunized the fund from the breach of contract claim and deleted a cause of action. Specified by statute, there's no cause.
The MPRA expressly does that, takes away.
Absolutely. I can cite the statutes if you'd like, Your Honor.
No, that's fine. A question about the plan documents, which are very complicated here, but as I understand them, even pre-MPRA, they allowed some modification in something like a financial red zone. If the fund was having some financial difficulty, short of insolvency, it wasn't quite insolvent, but it was in something akin to a financial red zone. Is that a fair reading of rights that the fund had prior to the statute? And if so, what did the statute allow them to do that they couldn't do before?
I would need to look at the specific – it's a contract. And so there are specific remedies when specific things happen. That is inconsistent, respectfully, Judge Stark, with my understanding of how it operated. You had to get into insolvency. Had it hit insolvency, my clients would have been miserable and unhappy, but – the agreement would have specified you can get certain cuts.
They had no rights to the payments in insolvency, right?
They did have rights to payments in insolvency. It specifies what happens if there's not enough.
No,
it's like bankruptcy.
Payments would be cut back, right?
Possibly. It actually would depend largely on what UPS would do. UPS paid about 80% of the overall proceeds
Forget about the possibility of additional contributions to the fund. If the fund was the fund and it was insolvent, they suffered a pro rata reduction, right?
if there needed to be a reduction. But if UPS withdrew, which it might very well have, UPS would have either paid enough to continue paying them somewhere around 70%. There has not been factual discovery or fact finding on exactly what percent. But they would have received most of their benefit from UPS staying in the fund. Or what would more likely have happened, UPS would have said, this is a sinking ship, let's get out of here, and then they would have had to pay withdrawal liability. They would have put well over $1 billion in, and it would have covered my clients way beyond their lifetime. They would have received 100 cents on the dollar.
The suspension went into effect in October 2017.
Correct.
It seems it was undisputed. The fund still had 10 years of life in it. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And one of the plaintiffs, Mr. Galutz, has passed away since then. So there's no dispute that he would have...
Tell me on this. If the red brief at 41 to 42, the government says this is not their preferred position.
Mm-hmm.
But if they lose on the property interest, if they lose on the per se taking, they say... Rather than enter judgment for you, we should remand because there's a dispute about which members of the class were damaged, and maybe some that weren't even damaged overall, because the government stepping in here increases the likelihood that folks are going to get paid. From your perspective, what, if anything, would be wrong with an outcome where we send it back for those damages findings, and you have to show that... whatever value the government created by saving the fund, because now I think it's got 30 years of life on it, is somehow lesser than what you lost.
For both the named plaintiffs and the 700 widows who got absolutely nothing, lost their husbands and the pension, that would be a wonderful resolution, Your Honor.
And is there any authority that says this relative benefits doctrine, which the government refers to on those two pages of the red brief, is there anything that says for a per se takings, the court cannot consider the relative benefits created by the government?
Yeah, thank you. Horn suggests, that's the Raisins case, that you don't look at offsetting benefits. I want to acknowledge there are cases saying, yes, you look at them, even in the per se. This court has in the past.
The Raisin case wasn't, they didn't give them offsetting raisins. They gave, there were other benefits to the program in terms of the structure. I mean, you certainly have to consider what the value was under A and D of what was taken.
But A and D was not a per se case, which goes to Judge Stark's case. In Horn, the court expressly rejected the premise.
Under your theory, it would have been a per se case.
It would be a per se taking. Horn was a per se taking. And yeah, Judge Stark,
in a regulatory takings analysis, like A and D,
you can look at the offsets.
Would have to consider the
yes.
Offsets. So my question to you is, if I agree with you that this is a per se taking, other than Corn, which I think leaves the question open, but other than that case, do you think there is law that would say I could not remand to the Court of Federal Claims and say it's a per se taking, but you do have to consider the relative benefits?
Horn would be the best case to cite, Your Honor, and almost an identical argument was rejected there that the government is making. The idea, and this goes to your point, Judge Dyke, it wasn't just these vague benefits. The whole idea is give us a big cut of your raisins, and then your prices will be higher, and you benefit. And the court said, with the analogy we used in our briefing, is it's like the government taking your car and saying, you're so lucky you don't have to pay it for insurance or for repairs. And the court in Horn basically said, nah, we're not buying that.
Okay, I think we're out of time.
Thank you.
We'll give you 2 minutes. Mr. Wong?
May it please the court. We do believe, to Your Honor, Judge Chen's question, that it is relevant here and important to consider the extent to which Congress's actions here were taken to protect participants like these and the nation's multi-employer pension fund system more generally. This was not a direct action, but rather an attempt to shore up a system that was in deep trouble. It doesn't sound in taking jurisprudence, partly for that reason and for a host of others as well.
But what is the line beyond which the government can't go under that reasoning? It seems like there is no line. And for example, the way the blue brief puts it, and I'm sure you've seen these analogies, the Court of Federal Claims opinion, which is you're endorsing on this point, would empower the government to transfer at its will to another party the rights of up to 50% of any retiree's vested pensions. Do you deny that your position would allow the government to do that?
Yes, we do, Your Honor. So
you do deny
yes, we do deny that.
Understand.
I apologize.
I don't understand.
Yes, we deny that, and the reason is that what I've just stated is an ultimate conclusion, but there are a series of analytical steps that we take to get there, and at each step, we believe that the appellant's arguments fall short. So we assert there's no property right here, and the reason why there's no property right is based on the specific structure of ERISA and the Internal Revenue Code as relates to multi-employer pension plans. And the fact that these...
But if you're right that there is no property right here, then the government can step in and redirect 50% of their non-property right vested pension, correct?
The government can modify an existing regulatory regime and the bundle of rights that come with plaintiff's pension,
plan doesn't include... They have a contract right here, don't they?
It is akin to a contract, right? It's a different body of law,
so
but it's functionally the same.
Under our cases, that's a form of property. And the question is whether that modifications to that third-party contract right is going to be analyzed under the regulatory takings jurisprudence, which is where it's been analyzed for like 100 years, or whether it's going to be considered to be a per se taking. That, for the moment, that seems to be the critical question here. And I'm not aware of any cases where the modification of a contract right per se without an interest in the underlying property has been held to be a per se taking. It may be a regulatory taking, but it's not a per se taking. Isn't that the correct analysis?
Yeah, yes, Your Honor. So if the court is inclined to find a property interest, and I can come back to that, but if the court is inclined to find a property interest, we agree, first of all, that Louisville Bank does not touch upon this sort of situation because the property there was a secured interest in real property, and change to the bankruptcy code impaired the bank's ability to get its security in the event of default. And so that's very different from this case where we're talking about a right that is based in a pension plan that is akin to a contract, and as the Supreme Court held in Connolly and Concrete Pipe, that sounds in the court's regulatory takings jurisprudence. And for reasons we've explained, this is not a regulatory taking. The financial loss was not serious enough under this court's...
The facts here are at least somewhat different from Connolly and Concrete Pipe in that what we have here is a specific identifiable interest in a quantified amount of money. These people worked for 20, 30 years, and all along the way they were earning certain rights to a pension, and so they were accruing a certain amount and then it vested, and then they retired, and they vested in that right to get those very payments, a very specific number. And that wasn't Connolly. I agree, it was all about pension funds, more broadly speaking, but here the nature of what we're looking at as the property interest could be understood as being something different than what the employers were dealing with when they had to pay some penalty to withdraw. So it comes down to really understanding what is the nature of this property interest. Like, you just accept the idea that for purposes of this argument, the court thinks there's a property interest of some kind here, and we're trying to understand the nature of it. Why would it be wrong to think of this as a vested right into a sum certain for these people?
Your Honor, I believe that Connolly and Concrete Pipe are not so different in the sense that the plaintiffs there were asserting that they were protected by contracts that they had with the pension plans that kept them from being required to pay in, I believe, a withdrawal liability. So the nature of the right that they were claiming sounded in contract just as it does here. Now, to an important point here, the appellants here have no right in the trust estate. I think that's established at this point. They only are paid what is provided by the plan. They have no access to that amount of money other than as the plan provides.
So speaking on a broader level, and I'm speaking on a more granular level for these particular plaintiffs and what they believe they earned and what they believe that they were promised, there's particular some certain. And I'd like you to try to focus on that a little bit, and obviously your position as well. There's still something wrong with that understanding of the property interest. There's maybe strings attached to it or something like that, but I need you to speak to that.
Sure.
Not more broadly about, well, these were all contracts, so anything goes under Connolly. I mean, speak a little more specific to the facts at hand, please.
Sure. So the specific amount of payments that are provided under the plan document after you've reached certain accrual points, those are subject to amendment by the plan, by the fund. And so what these appellants were to receive was not ironclad. It was as subject to the fund, which as fund's plan document, which of course is based in ERISA, and ERISA provides certain protection, a lot of protections to participants. But there were always
cutback provision, for example.
Right. The anti-cutback provision, which had exceptions before the passage of the MPRA, and now the MPRA adds an exception to the anti-cutback rule for failing plans that want to save themselves. But to your question, it's never been the case that there was a specific sum amount to which they were always entitled. Yes, the plan document inarguably calculates or provides formulas for calculation of what a given participant will be entitled to, but that is changeable, and the fund can change. And the fund, any changes to the plan must be pursuant to ERISA and the Internal Revenue Code if the fund wants to maintain its tax-exempt status, but there can be changes. And so we agree that vesting is important. Clearly, that's an important right. It is a ability to claim whatever you do.
Why is it permissible for this 2014 law to impact existing, you know, pension holders?
So I think to answer that question, we look to the regulatory takings test. We ask about the extent of the financial harm, the reasonable investment backed expectations, and the character of the government action. And we run it through that paradigm, and we submit that there's no way, considering those Penn Central factors, to conclude that this amounts to regulatory taking. And so I think really the case, this appeal really focuses in some ways on per se versus regulatory. And the reason why it's not a per se taking is, again, it's not like Brown. There hasn't been an appropriation of money owned by these individuals, but rather there's been a frustration of what they expected to occur under an existing pension plan akin to a contract. And using the regulatory takings test, which Your Honor Judge Dyke, I think, has suggested has been the usual course, you can't conclude that there's been a taking here, particularly due to the lack of financial impact. These individuals, of course, have been repaid, but even without that repayment, we see that it was a 29% reduction, and assuming there's 29%, there are problems with that assumption.
You're doing
that's
a
not
regulatory
enough.
Taking analysis right now.
I am, Your Honor, yes.
I want to keep that to the side while we're still asking the first question, which is, why isn't this a per se taking?
I perhaps misunderstood your question, Your Honor. So it's not a per se taking because all of the per se takings cases focus on some piece of property that is owned by the takings plaintiff that has been appropriated by the government in some way. And obviously taking of real property is sort of paradigmatic, but it can also be, as we see in Horn, raisins, personal property, things like that. Brown, it was money. It was only that the plaintiffs owned was taken. Here, the plaintiffs never owned anything other than this trade of promises.
Which case says it has to be ownership as opposed to a contractual right in order to apply a per se takings test?
Well, I think it needs to be appropriation of something.
Why
can't
it be appropriation of a contract right? What case says it can't be that?
I don't believe that. I don't have a case that says precisely that, but I don't think it's possible to read Connolly and Concrete Pipe otherwise. I think those cases stand for the proposition that where there's been an impairment in a commercial relationship, like a contract right or here a pension plan.
Why can't it be that even in a multi-employer pension plan, when we look from the employer side of things, an employer that wants to withdraw has to pay a penalty but can use any source of funds that it has access to pay that penalty, okay, that's a regulatory taking. When we look at the same plan from the perspective of the employee who has this contractual interest to payments calculated according to the plan, that for that, it's a per se test.
Because, Your Honor, in both instances, the takings plaintiffs are saying, I am protected from what the government has done by my existing exchange of promises with a third party.
Are you saying the government's position is a contractual right, no matter how specific, no matter how vested, no matter how important to them, can never be a basis for a per se taking test?
I am saying that I'm not aware of a case in which this court or the Supreme Court has held that that action would amount to a per se taking.
There's no case that said that can't be.
I'm sorry?
You've also acknowledged, I think, there's no case that says that we couldn't so hold.
Right.
Well, I mean, Concrete Pipe says specifically contracts may create rights and property, but when the contracts deal with a subject matter that deals within the control of Congress, they have a congenital infirmity. Parties cannot remove their transactions from the reach of dominant constitutional power by making contracts about them. I mean, there's language in lots of cases saying that if it's a contract situation, it's not outside congressional power to deal with it, and it's not necessarily a taking. It's only a taking if it's a regulatory taking.
Yes, Your Honor. I did not have that language at the top of my mind, but that's right. Concrete Pipe does say that, and I think it goes to the nature of Congress's role here in balancing the benefits and burdens of economic life, realizing that that's usually touched upon in the regulatory takings analysis, but also considering that this is an area that Congress is regulating, and it doesn't touch upon the sort of property interest that we traditionally see as a subject of taking, which, for example, might be based in traditional state law conceptions of property.
What if the 2014 law was written differently, and it went along the lines of for any fund, multi-employer pension fund, that is in real financial distress and is, you know, going to go insolvent within the next decade, we hereby call for those funds to reduce pension payments by 30%. In addition, any and all payments that have been sent out in the past 365 days, the funds need to get 30% of those payments back.
Right. So if the law had mandated reductions in repayment rather than making them voluntary, is that?
That's one part. And then the second part is doing a clawback.
Right. So
because of the huge financial distress that the multi-employer pension fund is in.
Right. So I that would potentially raise what I'll call A&D questions. I think at that point, perhaps there's more of a coercion argument because it's being mandated. But more precisely to your question, I think our position would still be that this is a question of whether or not that is an act by Congress that constitutes a regulatory taking rather than a per se taking. Well, I should say, it's a two-part question. If the money has already been paid to plaintiffs,
right,
I think that that's more like Brown. That is more like a situation where you've come into ownership through contractual performance and you're being required to repay some amount. So I think that would be a more problematic situation than looking forward reductions.
Once the money hits the pension holder's bank account, then it's untouchable? For as long as it's in the fund and there's an obligation to pay it out, anything goes, I guess.
Well, it's not that anything goes. It's that the pension plan provides for future payments.
Not anything goes, but that it's subject to a regulatory takings analysis.
Right, and it's a question of the fund's future expected performance rather than, okay, this takings plaintiff owns this money. And Brown, I think, tells us that if you take money that a plaintiff owes, then that's per se taking. It's different when you're talking about some sort of expected future performance under a contract or a pension plan.
That's one quick question. the appellants emphasize that what happened here is unprecedented.
Right.
That MPRA allowed, you know, taking like $1,000 a month from vested pensions that were already in payment status.
Right.
Is that disputed, or do you agree that that is unprecedented?
So it's not unprecedented. There are other intermediate measures that funds can take to avoid insolvency. But our primary point on that is that if the fund fails, then these participants' benefits are cut to the level of the PBGC guarantee, or potentially, which is, as we pointed out in the briefs, a dramatic reduction, 81% for one of these appellants. And so that is always a danger that is there, and that is inarguably part of the ERISA and IRC regulatory scheme, and benefit that participants see from that is that the pension benefit insurance fund protects them and at least gives them the PBGC guarantee. So it's not unprecedented because there's always the backdrop of fund insolvency, in addition to the intermediate sort of exceptions to the anti-cutback rule. If there are no further questions, we respectfully ask that you affirm.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Messon, you've got 2 minutes.
I'm sorry. I believe I reserved 3 minutes, Your Honor.
Well, I don't care. You used it up.
Okay.
You're lucky to have 2 minutes.
Well, I appreciate the time. My friend said that this was not unprecedented. The 30B6 deponent for Treasury stated on Appendix 5559, quote, reducing benefits that are in pay status is something that has not happened before. It's unprecedented. My friend said that, quote, obviously they've been repaid. The named plaintiffs have. More than 1,100 people haven't, including 700 widows. They lost a lot. They didn't get it back. The idea that it's all been repaid is just wrong. My friend said that he was unable to cite specific cases. For two propositions. One, that ownership is required, and two, that per se taking can't arise out of a contract. We cited 7 for each, including 3 that have both. Casitas had both. They didn't own the water, the plaintiffs, and it arose out of a contract, and yet the per se taking applied. Webbs, money was placed in interpleader. There was a fight over who owned it. The interest itself arose under a contract. So there was a contract there. Did they own the money? That was still in dispute. That was still being battled over. And the money arose out of a contract, and yet the per se taking test applied. Darby Development, that's a little bit different. But Your Honor dissented on the authorization question, Judge Dyke, but didn't dissent, as I understand it, on the question of whether the underlying action would constitute a per se taking. That arose out of a lease agreement. There are numerous other lease agreements where there's no ownership. General Motors, for instance, where the government appropriated property under a lease. There was no ownership, and it arose under a contract. So between General Motors, Casitas, and Webbs, you have 3 cases that individually, just any of those, shoot down both of the government's alternative theory to the CFC's theory, which we've shot down in our brief, and the government doesn't even try to defend.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.